Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Living legend Buddy Guy has had the blues since he was a young boy on a Louisiana farm, cut off from the larger world. But in the years since he made the bold step to leave that sea of corn stalks, he has done as much to shape the blues as anyone. A direct link to the blues heyday of figures like Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf, Guy was ranked number 30 on Rolling Stone's list of the greatest guitarists of all time. He's a six-time Grammy winner, a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, a recipient of the National Medal of Arts, and an influence on axemen from friend and collaborator B.B. King to Jimi Hendrix to Eric Clapton to John Mayer. In his mid-70s, Buddy Guy has come a long way from the moment he picked up his first guitar, a second-hand, two-string instrument that he initially found difficult to master. He remains a compelling showman and singer in concert today.
You're damn right I got the blues. You damn right I got the blues from my head down to my shoe.
He's telling his life story now in a new memoir called When I Left Home, which is published by DeCapo. Buddy Guy, what a pleasure to welcome you to the Roundtable.
Well, thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to tell your story now?
I was approached about this some time ago, and this is new to me, and I got a conversation with David, and I looked around, and there's nobody else that can answer those questions about me. Everybody else is gone, sad to say, but it was so many great musicians that could have probably did a better job than what I did on it, but I looked around, and as he said, if I don't get it from you now, I don't know who to go to now. Ain't hardly nobody left but me and B.B. who can go back through that. And B. didn't come into Chicago. He said he hung around in Tennessee. Because every time I talk to him, he say he wish he had a came to Chicago. But I'm left here with all that, I guess you call history inside of me. So I decided to say, why not? You know, better late than never.
You've been speaking about your co-author, David Ritz. Did you enjoy the process of looking back on where you've been?
Oh, man, you know, you don't forget things like this. I don't know if it's in the book. I haven't reread the book yet or not, but I always say, you got me out of Louisiana, but you never got the Louisiana out of me.
Did you have happy memories of your early life? It was a tough childhood in many ways.
You know, that's the way it was back then. You know, I would complain if I was the only one being like that. But everybody in the South during my time, which is 76 years ago on the 30th of this month, and most, well, I was born up, it was sharecropping, and you lived to eat and eat to live. And my parents, they never know what a bank was as of today. They've been long gone, but they didn't know what a bank was. Their bank was a sock up under the mattress in the bed under the pillow, and we never had a lock on our doors because back in those days you couldn't get anybody to go in your house if you wasn't there. That's the respect we had. Wish I had it today, you know, and that's the way it was, you know. You couldn't look up and see a future of even buying a car back then. I was considered my little horse, which is a little pony, was my car, and that's all I would ever have. And I've been blessed to say, you taught yourself how to play the guitar, and look what happened. Because back then, when I was teaching myself, you couldn't say, well, if I be good, I can get paid. Well, no such thing as that.
It's just an amazing change of times. You write about remembering the day your family got its first electric light, and how big a moment that was for the family. It's hard to even imagine that today.
Yes, you can't hardly explain. I try to explain it to my grandchildren and things like that. You know, that's hard unless you see that. And the length of time is, you know, I don't even think they write that in your history books now. You know, that's you just have to experience that. and be my age or so, a little older, to experience that, because my family wasn't the only one that didn't have lights. There wasn't no electricity coming to the whole little plantation where we had. I think the owner of the plantation had one light bulb before they decided to string where we could cut in and get one light bulb in the house with one socket hanging from the light bulb.
Well, your book is called When I Left Home. How did you decide to leave Louisiana for Chicago? Why did you do it? What did you expect when you left?
Well, I was working at the LSU in Baton Rouge. And matter of fact, my whole family just about retired from there. And I left because I had learned how to play Jimmy Reed and Two Licks of Lightning Hopkins. And then B.B. King came out, and Leo Fender and B.B. started playing the guitar the way no one else have ever played it. And I had learned a few notes of that, Jimmy Reed, Lightning Hopkins, and someone come told me I could come to Chicago and work at a university and make twice the money that I was making at LSU, because the wages in the North was much higher than in the South, because the cost of living was more, too. But my thing was, they told me I could work in the daytime and just go see Muddy Waters and all those great blues players was living here at night, and there was no cover charge. So I say, hey, you know, and my mom had a stroke, and I said, oh, my God, I got a choice to make. But she mumbled to me that she never did want me to not go after something or go see the world if I could afford it, because they had dedicated their life to that farm and never left. I don't think she ever left the state of Louisiana before she passed away. And they was always proud if we wanted to go and try something else, but always remember, call me and I'll send for you and always come back home. So I came here to do the normal work. I didn't ever think I was good enough to be talking to you today as a professional musician. That never was a dream come across my mind. And it just happened. I don't even know how it happened. I think the religious thing my mother and them taught me is be right and blessed, and there's something for you. If what's for you is going to come. If not, it's not going to come. And I live by that. And it just happened. You know, I came in, they found out I could play a lick. I learned a few things from Muddy Waters, Lil Walter, and Howlin' Wolf. And they found it out. Next thing I know, they was asking me to play with them.
When you got on that train, you never thought you could make a living in Chicago playing music, and the first few times you were on stage, you were so shy that you were facing the wall. When did you realize how good you were?
Well, I was in Baton Rouge when I was facing the wall. I had learned how to play a Jimmy Reed, and a guy came to the service station. I was pumping gas at LSU, and he said, I can help you out. I know you want to go to school. Your mother done had a stroke. He knew me, and he had a little two guitars and a harmonica and drums. He said, I can pay you much as you make here, and you can work at night and go to school in the daytime. And that's when I was too shy to sing, you know, and I didn't think I could sing well enough for nobody to pay attention to me anyway. So all that was in against me, you know, so far as I'm concerned. But everybody else, I would sing for two people in the house, you know. I had a couple of friends, and they're the one keeps saying, man, if I could do that, I'd go out and play that guitar and have all these good-looking girls and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, go ahead, man, you know. So, as I said, I didn't plan nothing, you know. And when I got to Chicago and saw all these great musicians, some of the guitar players didn't hang with it long enough because wasn't nobody getting paid. And by the way, when I arrived here 55 years ago, this September the 25th, Muddy, Wolf, Walt, all those guys was making those hit records, wasn't getting no money. They was playing in clubs here. There was no cover charge, and the bill was 20 or 25 cents a bottle. And when they started playing at night, it went up a dime, and that's what they paid, that extra dime on the bill. So I'm like saying, oh, wait a minute, you know. I thought these guys were doing better than this. I think Muddy was the only one who had a little house. Everybody else was kind of living like I was before I left the South. So I didn't see no future in none of that, but I loved that they get to play guitar playing, and I taught myself so well. And I joke about it because I came here September, and that's when all the birds go south. But I didn't have much sense of the birds. I came north, and you know how cold it gets in Chicago, and I have people laughing today. I say, after I met Muddy, Wolf, and Walter, Late Jr. with all those guys, I forgot how cold it gets, man. That's how much I was in love with what they were doing.
You're now, you have a club in Chicago. You spend a lot of time there listening to music, sitting at the bar. How does the music that you hear today in your own club compare to what you heard when you first arrived there?
You know, I don't think the music have changed that much, but technology have changed so much, man. You know, when I first picked up it with acoustic, then Leo Fender and Les Paul amplified it and electrified a lot of it. And you could hear it better. But now you got special effects, man, on I think Hendrix made that famous. And, yeah, the sound, you get out all these special effects are different, but I think blues is blues, jazz is jazz. Rock and roll, everything was R&B in the beginning. And if you got your record player now that used to didn't play nothing but the 7/8, which spin real fast. I said, if you got you in those record players, play the 45 and the album, say, let's go get you a 78 and put it on and turn the speed down, you'll find blues in everything you play.
Well, you've toured often with the Rolling Stones, and there was a line in the book where you mentioned you thought Elvis had learned well from the blues you were accustomed to hearing. Do you think that white popular rock and roll musicians have been good for the blues?
Oh, yeah, man. Without them, I don't think you would know who, I can't say that, but they the one opened the doors. The British guys did it first, you know. The Ed Sullivan Show, when Elvis broke loose, he was upsetting the whole world with the music he was playing when they come up with the name rock and roll and all that. And I'll never forget, I love the song he did better than any of them. Everybody disagreed with me, but all shook up. And I said, man, this cat is cooking, you know. And he went to Ed Sullivan's show, and they said, Ed Sullivan said, I can't show you from waist down. I can show you from waist up, because they wasn't ready for that boogie-woogie and shaking and kicking your legs like he was doing. But Little Richard and Louis Jordan and all them guys was doing that. And that's why Elvis had went down and saw that, man. And they was trying to hide it from the white kids. But, you know, after something like that break loose, you can't hide it. And from that to the British, when the British started coming out with the Eric Clapton and the Cream and the Rolling Stones, they had a television show called Shindig, and they was trying to get the Rolling Stones, and finally Mick Jagger said, I'll do it if you let me bring on Muddy Waters. And they asked, who was that? And he said, you mean to tell me you don't know who Muddy Waters is? And we named ourselves after one of his famous records, Rolling Stone. Which they did, and white America started saying, wait a minute, and it's not a British invasion with the music. And that's when the first time I saw Muddy and the Wolf on a television, the Rolling Stones had to introduce us to the white audiences here in America. Well, you had one or two people know about us, but they was like, you know, that's, I don't want my kids to know that kind of music.
Buddy, why is food so important to you? You write a lot about cooking, about finding ingredients. That was really interesting to me.
Well, if you go to Louisiana, man, I tell my sisters and brothers, I'm finna go down there now. I'm trying to, somebody trying to get me to open a club back down there. You know, if you go to Louisiana, man, you know, 7 o'clock this morning, they'll be to woke you up to make it, wake up and eat, then you can go back to sleep. They don't hesitate about eating there, man. So, you know, I grew up with that. And as I said earlier to you, my parents owned a farm. It was eat to live and live to eat. This time of year, we almost grew everything we had to eat, you know, all the veggies and things like that. We had our chickens on the yard. We'd kill the chicken and pluck the chicken. Wasn't no such a thing as salmonella. If it was, I would have had it. I'm 76 in the next week, and I ain't never had that. All this is new stuff, and I think it's not changing the conversation. I think it's got to do with what man feeding the chicken now, because our chickens ate corn, insects, and stuff like that. And And we didn't have no problem with that. We didn't have no problem with the pigs being slaughtered. And now you go get I was in the store yesterday trying to buy some drumsticks for my grandkids, and I had to ask the guy, was that a turkey leg or a drumstick for a chicken, you know? And you didn't see no drumstick on a chicken that big when I was on the farm, man. I went and bought some shrimp the other day, and they call it a colossal shrimp. That thing was big as my fist.
Buddy, you've mentioned your age a couple times. Can you see a day where you don't play music anymore? Will you ever retire from being the great musician you are?
You know, it crosses my mind, but all the great guys who I learned everything from are no longer with us, and all I learned from them that blues musicians don't retire, they just drop.
Look at Pine Top Perkins, had a vital album just a year ago in his 90s.
Right. Not only him, you had Robert Jr. Lockwood was a guitar player, made a lot of records with at the Chess with all of those, Lou Walton and all of them. All of them was 90-something, you know, Pine Top, Honey Boy Edwards. All them guys was in their 90s when they passed away, and they still were playing, man. And I would look at them and say, you know, it's a part of our life. You know, I don't think, you know, if long as I'm doing something makes someone happy, I think it might help, you know. And I'm like saying, if I'm making somebody smile and pat their feet and clap their hands, why quit? Even though I wish I could one day, because I do get tired. I don't have the energy I had when I was 23 and 24. But I have so much fun making other people happy.
We've been speaking with Buddy Guy. He's the author of a new memoir called When I Left Home. The book is published by DeCapo. Buddy Guy, we will save you a slot on the show in about 20 years from now, and you'll have to come back on and tell us about these intervening years. I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for being on the show.
And thank you for having me. Anything you can do for the blues, I appreciate it. And whenever you need me again, I'll be more than happy.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.